Hello, I hope you've got your complimentary cocktails to hand, because this is the Super Deluxe VVVVVIP edition of Big Mouth. It's $100,000 a ticket, we're recording on Pablo Escobar's private beach, Drake is mixing cocktails, and I'm in a fetching bikini by Helmut Lagerfeld. Isn't that right, Sian?
Not remotely, Andrew. Welcome to this week's Big Mouth, where you'll be unsurprised to learn we'll be talking about the Netflix Fyre Festival movie, the one that threatens to knock Bross, after the screaming stops, off its perch as the movie Jaw-Jaw-Jaw-Jaw-Jaw-Dropper-De-Nose-Jaws. That's de nos jours. Is the story of the New York entrepreneurs who pretended to put together a luxury festival in the Bahamas and instead laid on a small-scale humanitarian disaster a healthy slice of schadenfreude? Or should we be a bit less gleeful in watching tearful Instagram influencers wailing over how small their cheese sandwich is? Plus, at the polar opposite of pop, we've got All the Young Droogs, a 60-track compilation of bin-end bover rock from the 1970s. Will it have us donning our monkey boots and going all suede-ed? And we've got Rude Boy reunion albums from The Specials and The Beat featuring Ranking Roger. Can they and we still moonstomp at our age?
Helping us out this week, we've got two guests. Lucy O'Brien is a pop writer and academic who graduated from NME and Select to writing proper books. As our Madonna desk correspondent, what do you think of the reports that she's going to do another grand all singing, all dancing tour? And the reports all say, and isn't it amazing because she's 60? As if like being 60 is like being 80. Is it actually going to happen, do we think?
Oh, yes, the tour will happen because she absolutely loves it. She that's where she really comes to life. I doubt that there'll be sort of aerobic skipping or anything like that. I think it will probably be the dancers will do the hefty work, and she'll probably do singing and move rather elegantly around the stage.
Because I'm rather desperate for the mature period Madonna, I Am Barbra Streisand, materialising in the middle like the ornament on her own huge mantelpiece kind of.
Well, I used to joke about her singing Warbling Like a Virgin at 80, and I think she probably will be.
I can't wait, actually. Because the best song she's done in years, I thought, was that track masterpiece from the film, the terrible film she did, but the song is
beautiful,
incredible, and it's grown-up Madonna.
Well, actually, this album, some of her influence is Portuguese Fado, and I think that, you know, that bodes well. Because she's been living in Lisbon for a while, and I think she's probably just absorbed a lot of that.
You can do a lot of kind of expressive dancing without having to move very much to Fado, can't you?
Exactly.
It's all in the elbows.
It's perfect.
Absolutely.
Can you explain Fado to people who don't know
well,
what Fado is?
The translation of that would be melancholy.
Oh.
It's the sort of main Portuguese style. It's wonderful. It's like a ballad style. Cesária Vora sang in that way, and it's quite plaintive. It's quite mournful. Very beautiful.
That's good.
Wow, yes. Mm. Also joining us today is The Guardian's chief music writer and a graduate of the Mixmag School for Wayward Youngsters. He lists his interests as gin and the Bee Gees, and he once appeared in The Life of Rock with Brian Pern, captioned as Baz Bamib.
Baz Bamig Boy.
Back on Big Mouth after too long a break, it's Alexis Petridis. Hello, Alexis.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me back.
How did you end up on the Brian Pern programme?
I was just asked. Oh. It was really, really odd. They asked me to do it, and they filmed it in exactly the same place that they filmed those. You know when they do the Top of the Pops, the year of 1977, you know, those documentaries on BBC Four, and you filmed it in exactly the same place as that. And the interview went on for ages, and they interviewed me as though this band really existed. And then they used about 2 seconds of it and captioned me Baz Bamig Boy. But it was good, yeah. It was.
Were you in on that? Were you in on the Baz Bamig
Boy?
No,
I wasn't. No, absolutely not. I laughed just as much as everyone else did.
Do we know what Baz Bamig Boy thinks about this?
I've never asked him. I've never had the pleasure of Baz Bamig Boy's company, unfortunately.
No.
Did you walk away from that interview feeling that Brian Pern's musical output was actually real? If they interviewed you for that long?
Yeah, in a weird way, because it was all about, the interview was all about the, what was this band called? Thoth.
Thotch.
Yes.
It was all about this sort of, the power struggles with it. It was exactly like being interviewed for one of those documentaries some long-standing thing. So yes, I was in that headspace. And then, rather bizarrely, did they interview Billy Bragg for it as well? I think Billy Bragg sort of walked in as I was leaving, which added an extra sort of degree of surreal you know, to it. Anyway.
In a career spotted with highlights, was that the zenith?
Yes.
You wrote a piece at the end of last year about the troubled year of SoundCloud rap.
Mm.
And if you haven't read that, readers, it is very troubling.
It's about as troubling as it gets.
There's a lot of people with facial tattoos who are very sad inside.
Until I started examining the world of drill rap.
Right.
By contrast with which SoundCloud rap looks like Thotch. it's just, some of that is just, it's literally gangs on estates in London rapping about stabbing each other and then going out and stabbing each other.
Oh, God.
It's genuine. It's one of the first times, you know, you feel that you're sort of immune to shock in music. Mm. You know, lived through lots of different, you know, shock horror kind of tabloidy headlines. And this was one where I just turned into a dad, and I was like, "No, this, I'm sorry, this is completely wrong." Like, you know, and some of the music is quite good, but the lyrical content of some of it that I saw is just.
You just wish they were listening to something healthy like the Ghetto Boys.
Yeah, yeah.
But what are the troubled youth seeing in the troubled youth narrative? Do you think?
I don't think that it's necessarily the the troubled youth are seeing in the troubled youth narrative their own lives reflected in some ways, but in the troubled youth narrative of SoundCloud rap, I think what's more important about SoundCloud rap and why it's successful is how it sounds, which is something I was going to talk about later in the show, about the when we talk about, you know, the thing that has been vexing us or we've been thinking about this week. SoundCloud rap exists outside of the current pop system, which is very, very constrained for reasons we'll get into later. Yeah, and that's why it sounds the way it does. And suddenly that makes it incredibly exciting because all the tracks are like a minute and 20 seconds long and they're, you know, really lo-fi production.
Completely tearing up the rules.
The rule book, and the rule book is so sort of heavily implemented nowadays, which we'll get into later.
Particularly for people of colour.
Yeah, particularly people of colour or pop artists or any, you know, so anyway, yes, that is what I think. It's that it exists outside of the mainstream.
Medium is the message, man.
The medium is the message.
Well, before we get started, a quick reminder that there are now two very good reasons to support Big Mouth on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Number one, you get the show a whole day early. Yes, even now, our Patreon followers are listening in the actual future. Sign up and we'll send you each show via Patreon as soon as it's ready, so you can listen on Friday night and be the envy of your friends. Number two, the extra bit. Every week we record a little bit of extra conversation just for Patreon listeners. And this week we've got a bit more on the best and worst people that our guests have interviewed in their illustrious and indeed glittering careers. Just search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more about how you can help us cover our bills and get the show early and get more Big Mouth too. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
Unless you've been stranded on a desert island, you will be aware of the Netflix documentary Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. Clues in the title there. Seduced by supermodel sodden social media marketing, a bevy of so-called millennials with lots of money and minimum common sense were lured to an island in the Bahamas for what they were told was the most exclusive party in the history of partying. What they got instead, with emergency hurricane tents on a building site, no bands, DJs, and the luxury food replaced by the infamous cheese sarnies, was the Instagram Lord of the Flies, or perhaps Apocalypse LOL. Let's remind ourselves of the high point in Western civilization.
We need to get the messaging out now that this is not a luxury music festival.
Oh my God.
There's mattresses all over the place getting soaked.
The save yourself mode kicked in.
Right, it's a free-for-all.
It became this looting mentality.
There's an angry mob, they're pissed off and they want their money.
Powerful models built this festival, and then one picture of cheese on toast ripped down the festival.
Right, the Evian is stuck at customs. What are we all going to do about that then? Lucy O'Brien, this has everything, doesn't it? Revolting tech bros, credulous young people with too much money, the truly appalling Ja Rule as a celebrity hood ornament for the whole enterprise, and at the centre of it, the dreadful Billy McFarland who scams everybody. Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed both of them immensely, but it was a bit like eating too many sticky cakes, and that feeling you get when you've been scrolling through social media for far too long.
I should point out that there is also another one from Hulu, which you've watched on YouTube. We've all watched on YouTube as well. The Netflix one is the main, but there's the Hulu one as well, because you've seen both of them.
So these are competing documentaries. As my line manager used to say, the take-home point from this, the main thing was I felt I was in a sort of Ballard-style dystopia, And the actual villains of it are the influencers.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're aliens or replicants. You know, you feel like they're going to control society.
I am now imagining the Ballard novel Popularity Island.
Yeah, where, I mean,
which ends up with somebody barbecuing Kendall Jenner to
yes, yes, yes. After a while, what it boils down to is the influencers are sales. They're in sales and marketing. And they're not actually that different from the man that came round to my house last week to sell some windows. And I think that's what we really need to see social media for what it is in lots of ways. It is just marketing. The tale of Billy McFarlane is quite interesting, but then it's not just him, it's that whole large apparatus around it. And I actually think social media, when you look at it through this prism, is like a capitalist plot. It's like a massive distraction from real life and from any kind of political reality or activism.
I was expecting a huge dollop of completely unadulterated schadenfreude that I could enjoy. I could enjoy the misery of rich people because I hate the beautiful people. And yet, actually, it's not quite as simple as that, is it? Because many of the victims of the scam, both the people who've gone to the festival and certainly all the people who, the workmen and the caterers,
yes,
are total victims of this central idea of let's just do it and be legends, man.
Yes, I mean, I think that was the really poignant part, that wonderful statuesque woman, you know, but Bahamian and woman at
Mary
the end who
Roll.
Said,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, I've lost all this money and I don't want to talk about it, I'm hurt. Mm. And you really felt it, and then the camera really lingered on her face and you thought, yes, you know, this is the real cost of a total scam and a shit show, as they said, you know, many times.
Alexis, these are the people whose musical tastes you sometimes have to navigate via the Guardian and the usual Instagram music that they build their lives around. Did you enjoy the Netflix Fire thing?
I was just sort of more baffled by it than anything. The things that the various aspects of it I found baffling. One, throughout this documentary, Billy McFarlane is people go, oh, well, you know, he was so charismatic and he could just convince you to do anything and he had this awe about him. And you think, God, this guy's, you know, incredible. He's like sort of cross between, you know, the world's greatest salesman and Charles Manson or something. And then it would cut to him and he's just a tosser in every single thing. He was this completely uncharismatic, chubby idiot, continually chugging a Bud Light, fist bumping people and going around his office on a hoverboard. And it's just, you could have spotted this guy was a complete twat a mile off. Point number two, wow, we've got Ja Rule on board. Who cares about Ja Rule's career died on its ass in about 2004. Why is having Ja Rule, it's like having Top Loader on board. It's like, who cares about that? So I didn't understand that. I didn't understand the pull that these people allegedly had, other than the world in which they operate, which is the world of the internet and social media. Nobody really understands it. Mm. Nobody really. The people who will really understand it ultimately are my daughter, who is nearly 13's generation, and they're the people that have grown up with it as a fact of life throughout their lives, and they will be able to navigate it in a way that other people cannot. As a result of the fact that nobody really understands it, you can be this sort of total chancer on a hoverboard with a thing of Bud Light. And there was that weird woman, the backer, the kind of skinny blonde woman.
Carola.
Yes.
Carola.
He kept giving him more and more and more money, and he was sitting there. And, you know, all of us have sat in meetings with a bullshitter.
Yes,
and he was sitting there going, we can get more money because we're going to have a private party for Kendall Jenner and it's going to be $100,000 a ticket. We're going to sell 100 of them. I said, what are you talking about, you know?
I thought it was quite interesting that the musicians, not a jot, you didn't hear anything from the musicians. And
it
wasn't about the music. And also, they very sensibly had nothing to do with it and didn't turn up. So they kind of
that's
knew.
That's the interesting thing. I think Alexis touched on it there, which is the fact that, like, this isn't a music event. This is a social media event. And everybody involved doesn't have the first fucking clue about music.
Yeah.
You know, anybody who does would go, Ja Rule, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm not going to a desert island to see Disclosure. I can see him at Ali Pali.
Yes. Yes.
So it's actually, it's for people seduced by the glow of luxuriness, isn't it?
Yes, but I think that the people who are orchestrating the Fire Festival also don't understand social media. They don't understand the law, that if you promise something and you get lots of backers, you have some money, you actually do have to deliver.
As
he so wisely
says. He says, it's not fraud, it's just false advertising.
Yes, So there's a bit of a schism there. We have a gap between their understanding and the reality as well.
But it's a giant kind of metaphor, isn't it?
It is.
The Fyre Festival is this living metaphor.
The Fyre Festival happened, and it was the one with Kendall Jenner and Bella Hadid and the supermodels. That was where they and the wonderful bit where Billy has so much Bud Light, although I think it's tequila, that there's a shot of him falling asleep in the afternoon on the beach. He's so out of it. This is your boss.
Yes. The one that's meant to be managing things.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the companion, the Hulu one, which you can see on YouTube, which is like...
Before they take it off.
It's almost like the extended scenes. It's almost like, you know, the thing taken from another perspective. But they get the Billy interview, don't they? Billy's shiftiness is so enormous. I suspect that Billy's hustle is not Donald Trump, I am a success, it's going to be mega. It's to do something appalling and to say, yeah, it's really bad, it's on me. And then not change his behaviour in any way whatsoever. Because you're expecting the Great Gatsby in this kind of, you're expecting West Egg, glittering, whatever. And what you get is a fat idiot on a hoverboard and a jet ski he can't afford.
I think that's what makes it even more funny, that people were totally taken in by this.
And he looks like he's got in really bad trouble with his dad throughout the whole of that interview. You can see him thinking, bloody hell, dad's going to be so annoying.
Is there a third version?
There must be.
Which is like a Ferris Bueller fictional adventure.
Yes, it is Ferris Bueller, isn't it? It's gone massively wrong.
You know, oh no, Dad, I've accidentally set up a $700 million rock festival in the Bahamas. Oh, Ferris,
what have
you done now?
There were some quite dark bits. You know the bit about the models? They all get really drunk and Jarrell's trying to persuade...
Coercing them.
Yeah, coercing them. You're drunk now, should we go in the sea? And just think,
take your clothes off and jump in the sea.
Yeah, we'll film it.
I think it's really well directed in that there are little moments. So it's all made from found footage and collected YouTube videos and all the rest of it, but you dropped in at the right moment is a model with a very woody look on her face, which says an awful lot about what's really going on.
That nauseating
party bit where Ja Rule is going, God, we're gonna live like movie stars, party like rock stars, and fuck like porn stars. And you think, God, you're revolting. The basic level
sort of sums it up, really, doesn't it?
It's everybody's dream to go to Pablo Escobar's Island. No, it isn't.
But it's an idiot's dream to go to Pablo Escobar's Island. That's the thing, is the whole event, even if it had took place, I said this on social media, it was by arseholes for arseholes.
Yeah.
And it was arseholebury. It was arsehole fest. Reading and Leeds arsehole.
I read somebody on Facebook saying, looking at the way some of the punters behave, it's reasonable to ask,
they were awful.
Were they defrauded and traumatised enough?
Yeah.
Because
absolutely.
They should have been defrauded and traumatised more.
The Asian guy that goes, oh yeah, we didn't want neighbours, so we went around pissing on other people's mattresses and smashing their tents up. And it's like, how did you think that was going to come across?
You laughed. Because we're banterous legends.
Yeah.
And it's all lols. But interestingly, the Netflix Fyre thing is co-produced by Vice, and the reporter, what's her name, Bluestone, who I think gives she basically broke the story, put it together, and appears in the movie, is also an executive producer on this. Now, in one level, I think, fantastic, you've done a great exposure here. But another level, I think, Vice, you were patient zero for this behaviour.
Yes.
You celebrated, lauded, and created all of this, basically, be an asshole for fun and profit. Yes. And now you're standing there saying, well, gosh, it's really awful, isn't it, the way it's played out?
It is very Vice, isn't it? I mean, let's not forget that Vice started off as an advertising sheet, didn't it? And that's what it is. It's marketing. And I do remember hearing a Vice journalist being interviewed and them saying, oh, well, you know, it's all about the brand now. And, you know, forget being a music writer and having any personality. It's just, you know, really, we're all just in service of the brand.
Yeah. I mean, it's not short on astonishing characters, is it? We've got a character called David.
How do you think that's pronounced? I've been trolling
David, like Mbop.
Like Mbop.
It's David. So Alexis, he's just another twat in a Nirvana t-shirt. And the agency, the social media influencers agency, which is called Fuck Jerry.
Oh yes.
And their idea is
well. So daring.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? But my favourite was the finance guy Andy, the guy who was about to take one for the team.
But he's another guy.
Oh my God, that was weird.
For the Evian water in customs.
It comes back to this: that guy looked about my age, maybe older. He looked like late 40s, early 50s. Yeah. Again, well, I would. He was so charismatic. And he actually says, I mean, it's just remarkable. It's just remarkable they were taken in by
that. He will go and give someone a blowjob.
To get the Evian out of customs.
He was prepared to do it.
How does that work?
We could explain it, but it's a family podcast. I was amazed, though, that, like, you're seeing him. He struck me as, like, Tom in Succession or something. You know, the kind of, like, you know, the awful sort of, like, failed consigliere figure. You're right. It's amazing that people were taken in by this. But after it's all broken down and collapsed and, you know, the whole thing's gone bankrupt, we see Billy tried to start another scam, selling tickets to the Met Gala and Victoria's Secret fashion show under the name of Frank Tribble.
Now, Frank Tribble was a guy. Frank Tribble was a guy in a fire hat.
Yeah, and he seems to have like learned nothing, and the people around him have learned nothing either. They're perfectly happy to.
Well, David has set up a new thing with Ja Rule. I seem to remember. Wasn't that at the end? Because it worked out so well the previous time. There was some sense that Ja Rule was involved in some sort of new company with David, which didn't say much for David's judgment. But that was the other thing about these people that worked for him. The guy, beardy voice of reason yoga guy that kept appearing and was told by the Navy SEAL, this is a monumental clusterfuck in his head. Why did he not leave at any point? He actually he knows.
I have a suspicion.
Mark Weinstein.
I suspect to know the answer to this, which is the whole fire thing is predicated on you are at the hot zone of cool and this is what's happening. And if you think it's shit, it's because you don't understand it.
Yes, but there may have been a wages issue because remember that they get laid off without getting laid off, so they're working and they don't get paid.
This is in the Hulu one. Yeah. It's the magnificent Alan Partridge moment where they say, we're not sacking anybody. There's just no more work and no more money. Like, yes, we're getting a second series. It's astonishing. But what do we think of the comparison between the Netflix one, which most people have seen, and the Hulu one, which is kind of harder to see?
I think the Netflix one, the interviews are better and the production values are better. The Hulu one feels like it's been made on the hop. But actually, what's better about the Hulu one is you get the whole context and the whole millennial generation references.
It's also more businessy, isn't it?
And some good interviews, like the psychologist who was talking about the psychology of the con man and the scam. Mm. And so we get a real sense of how this could have happened.
I really enjoyed seeing in the Hulu one the business background. I found it slightly annoying the way it's the kind of documentary where when it says, and then in 2008, there was a financial crash, it has to be illustrated with a clip from the Jetsons of a dinosaur falling over or a kind of a clown car falling to pieces. It has that slightly annoying.
Documentary.
A bit mean-like,
It's slightly mean-like. So one of the key takeaways for me, I could tell your line manager about this, was I looked at this and I thought, okay, so they all turned up at a building site in the middle of the Bahamas with no music and no food.
It looked awful, didn't it? It was so grotty.
I've been to worse. I looked at this and I thought the Glastonbury audience would have breezed this.
Yeah.
They would have just
whatever. You're right.
Our proper rock festival. Idiots.
They'd have just
walked it.
Nowhere for people to stay. First time I went to Glastonbury, I climbed in over the I'm not giving it all here. When I was a lad.
When I was a
lad.
They were made of wood. David Bowie were made of wood.
But I climbed over the fence. I waded through a stream. I was bitten by a dog, a security dog. I got into the festival eventually. I had no tent, nowhere to stay. You know, I knew where my friends were, but vaguely. Yeah. I just stayed up for 4 days. That's how you do a festival properly.
It's like, and that was 2016, and you still filed your coffee,
didn't
you?
Absolutely.
No wonder it was a bit disjointed.
And then I went home and I took my children to school.
I just thought, I looked at these people and I thought, in one respect, I've got sympathy for you because clearly you're very cosseted people who are used to private planes. Mm. But on the other hand, you know, show a bit of initiative. You're a fucking desert island, lads. Well, you know, come on, you can do something here. Yeah. And then who cares if Blink-182 aren't on the crap
Make
anyway.
Your own party.
We'd make our own party. Absolutely. One thing also, one last thing on the Hulu, is that I think the Hulu one is kind of harder on the influencers in a very appropriate way. There's one whose name escapes me because I'm 50-odd. She's doubtless, your daughters would know them.
They would indeed, yes.
And she goes, well, it looked a bit bad, but hey, we got a house. Cut to her in the house, dancing around, having a great time in the house. Cut to people crying, where's the toilet? Where's the toilet? And you're like, the idea that you were all innocently scammed into this and bear no relationship at all to the outcome is a bit tenuous. Mm. We did see, however, you mentioned Marion the caterer. Subsequently, a GoFundMe was set up. Yes. I checked this morning. It's $170,000 at the moment, including $10,000 from Fuck Jerry. Which is clearly guilt money.
Yes.
Or maybe they're not just a bunch of dicks after all.
It would be great if those people get paid.
Yeah.
That's the main thing, is the people living and working on the island who should have got paid. Yeah.
Absolutely.
On the subject of the aftermath, I became faintly obsessed with David after watching it. I checked David's Twitter feed. And David, after the documentary came out last weekend, started posting these amazing motivational quotes, one of which was... they only throw in shade because you're shining so bright. And I was like, under what fucking circumstances did you watch that documentary and think that I'm shining so bright? You know, it's just...
Do you think it's bollocks, perhaps?
I think it's... Yeah. It's bullshit.
Well, one last thing on the aftermath. Ja Rule has been backpedaling furiously, saying that it was great to show entitled millennials what real hardship is, and maybe they've learned something from it.
Wow.
So, obviously, well, Sian, as a proponent of Bross, do you think this knocks Bross off the must-watch?
I'm sorry, I don't think it can do. Neck and neck, I would say, but Bross, they've got longevity, man.
They do. I think Evie and Andy is the Ken of this documentary. Anyway.
Right, let's tear our eyes away from this spectacle of human suffering. Sadly, it's time for a bit of music chosen by one of our guests in their editor's recommendation. Alexis Petridis, what have you got?
I've brought the new single, the first single from the forthcoming Fat White Family album, which is called Feet. The single is called Feet. I brought it in because Fat White Family are a band that I've always found seem to promise quite a lot and never quite deliver it. I thought that the first single from the last album, which is called The Whitest Boy on the Beach, was fantastic. And the album itself, I thought, was awful. I mean, it was really, really... terrible, am I shocking you now? Kind of, yeah, I've done a song about Nazis. And it was like proper, you know, it was rubbish. But this is just unequivocally a fantastic bit of kind of, I don't know, sort of baggy slash disco slash, it's a slightly menacing thing going on as well. It's a brilliant record.
It's smacky soul soul, isn't it? Let's have a listen. This is Fat White Family with Feet. Now, if it's possible to imagine the polar opposite of a load of influencers flicking peace signs from the deck of a yacht, it is the grubby, grimy, cheapo bin glam rock of the mid-1970s. Bowie, Slade and the Sweet generated more cheap and cheerful knockoffs than a bucket full of Banksy's. Curator Phil King of Lush and the Jesus and Mary Chain has christened this scene Junk Shop Glam, and he's put together a series of compilations including Velvet Tin Mine, Glitter Best and, unforgettably, Boobs. Now comes the motherlode, All the Young Droogs, a 3-CD, 60-track trawl into the primordial ooze of Junk Shop Glam, featuring acts with such evocative names as Biggles, Stud Leather, Ning and Iron Virgin. But it's also got cameos from Mott the Hoople, Iggy and the Stooges and the Spiders from Mars. Spoiler, this is Alexis Petridis' catnip, so let's get down and get with it after this track. This is Hello with Games Up. Let me on the line, no matter how much you play. Time's up. Bother sound of Junk Shop Glam there. Super yob, Alexis Petridis. Your enthusiasm for this stuff extends to your haircut. What did you make of All the Young Droogs?
It's very difficult for me to make any kind of critical judgment whatsoever about this music. I just love it unequivocally on every level. It's actually, you say it's interesting because you say it's the opposite of that Fire documentary. And obviously in some ways it is, but another way it isn't. Because the reason there is so much of this stuff, of this kind of unknown glam, of this kind of, whatever you want to call it, Junk Shop Glam, second-rate glam, whatever, is because, as in the kind of current world of social media and the internet, it appeared in the early 70s that all bets were off. If you have, you know, there's a vacuum there because the Beatles have split up, who sort of guide the music scene to a certain degree in Britain throughout the 60s. They go, there's this kind of weird vacuum, and the people that step into it and become leaders are these sort of odd kind of chancers from the 60s. It's like David Bowie, who'd been, you know, tried and failed to become famous throughout the 60s. Yeah. Mark Bolan, who'd been like this kind of plastic hippie and hadn't really, you know, the actual kind of counterculture hated him. And suddenly they're running things. And obviously everybody looks at it and goes, hang on, David Bowie's in charge now. Right, I can have a go.
It's like Matt Cardle becoming the greatest force on the face of the earth.
Totally. And then
which could happen.
So everybody, you know, and his dog has a go at making a glam record. And, I mean, this isn't, strictly speaking, just a glam compilation. There's other stuff on there. And I find the results, they're either brilliant and you can't believe they weren't hits, or they're just spectacularly entertaining.
Yeah. I mean, any particular favourite tracks about Working Class Man by Third World War?
Third World War are fascinating band. You don't want to start me on this because we'll be here for like hours and hours now. Third World War are a genuinely fascinating band. There's a track on here called Big Boobs Boogie, yes. Which isn't a particularly good track, but it's just such a sort of remarkable idea that somebody thought that was a great, you know, a great thing. It's divided into three categories. One's kind of hard rocking stuff. One is your actual kind of glam. And then there's elegance and decadence, which is people sort of
it's all like, you know, Aldi Gibraith, isn't it?
Yeah. it's people being louche. Some of whom are obviously quite louche to start off with and sort of effete and camp or whatever. And other people who clearly have absolutely no business being louche and effete. It's just fabulous from start to finish.
Lucy O'Brien, you and I can just about remember when this is happening for real. Yeah. And this was kind of like a formative thing for me as well. But yeah. It was like Slade and the Sweet Mouth Bullet. I had no idea the continental shelf went off so deep all the way to Iceland and New Zealand. Everybody around the world was making glam rock. Did you enjoy it?
I did. I had two responses. My first, my take-home points. first reaction was it really brought out the Benny Hill side of me in that I appreciated the humour of Big Boobs Boogie and Slow Load. What a great name.
Could be a shoegazing band, actually, Slow Load. Yes. Yeah.
But then the other thing I thought, it was almost like crate digging. And I always loved, in the 70s, I loved Cockney Rebel, Dr. Feelgood. And I liked Bebop Deluxe. And I always felt they were sort of standalone bands. They didn't seem to have a context. Mm. And what's brilliant about these three, because it's essentially three albums all in one compilation, that you get the context. So you get everything from that sort of proto-punk boogie to the elegant and wasted stuff at the end. And it totally fills out the picture. Alexis, you mentioned Third World War. I think that's a fantastic track. The bass line on that is amazing. Right at the end, we've got T.V. Smith from the adverts in his incarnation as Sleaze doing this there you go, doing a track called Showbiz Kid, where it sounds almost like a combination of Pink Floyd meets Pill. I mean, it's amazing.
I want the
Sleaze
T-shirt.
So there's some really, really interesting stuff there.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it, in the fact that you realise how much of pop is just like bolting the bits together. There's a particular track, White Stockings by Roy Allison, that starts out sounding exactly like Madness and then turns into cheapo Roxy music. And the result is kind of like a bit The Fall, a bit Suede, a bit Franz Ferdinand. These are the source code of all of your favourite things. Sian, I think you found this track a bit more heavy going there, didn't you?
Yeah, I found it really difficult because there are 60 songs. And what I decided to do is listen to all of the 60 songs in order on a Saturday afternoon and felt completely overwhelmed by about 10 of them. I mean, I think, if I'm looking contextually, I think this is an album about masculinity. How many women are on it? I mean, I couldn't really...
That's true.
How many women
were
involved in Glam Full Stop, I think.
Susan Quattro, that's about
really
it.
They're not on this record, but it's... Almost all the songs are either sort of the Bother Boy, Get Out My House is one of them, which
you
I think rather it's very Let's Go Down the Pub, and then half of the record is, well, he looks a bit like a man but he's actually a girl, or is he a girl looking a bit like a man? There's a lot of things about this, because obviously it was fashionable at the time. Effete sexuality is big, and it's a lot of very confused teenagers and young men trying to work this out with a glam rock beat. The irony is going on it. But there are these, I thought there were just absolute beautiful sort of gold dust in there. And the Brett Smiley track, who is very well known anyway. Abstracting Billy is just beautiful. There's something about it. And it sort of leaps out of this very, as I say, bother boot heavy irony, this sort of sludge of glam, into something else. And about this fragile, sort of broken soul, wanting to play the part of a fragile, broken soul, Billy the Kid. And suddenly for me, the sort of world expanded in that lovely way that it does. And there's also Criminal World by Metro, which Bowie covered for Let's Dance, is an amazing song. The lyrics are fantastic. You will probably know it already. But to hear the original of that, I thought there were real highlights in it. But as a big, big wadge of music, I think you have to sort of pick at it or go slowly. I went too fast.
I think if you'd gone into Chinny Chap and gone, he looks like a boy, but he might be a girl, and maybe it's a girl. They would have given you a record deal, and you would have been one of the big women of glam.
Gladys Knutson.
Missed that opportunity as a toddler.
Absolutely. I mean, is there a bit of chasing the high of the undiscovered here, in that, like, you would never have paid attention at the time, but now that it's rare and you can't get it, and it's so very, very, very different from everything else. I mean, most of these records would be banned from the radio for poor quality sexual politics, let alone musicianship. Is that it? I mean, objectively, a lot of these songs aren't very good, but what they are is very, very exciting.
Well, it's like an archive, isn't it? It is a bit like social history. For me, there were big gaps in that 1970s story. I think it's Tony Barber, isn't he? He does a really good intro in the booklet and talks about going to boot fairs over a period of decades and just rooting these things out. And the dedication of that collecting and kind of curating, I think it presents such an interesting picture. It's so British, isn't it? Such a slice of British life.
So, Alexis, you were scoffing then when I said a lot of these songs aren't very good.
I want to clarify
here, a lot of my favourite records aren't very good, but what they are is brilliantly exciting. I think being good is overrated in pop, actually.
I think what's good about this, I think the thing that I like about this is the sort of big glam records that we all know and love, whether that's Virginia Plain or Starman or even Slade's records, they exist in the present. They exist in a kind of constant present. They're part of the ether around us. You hear those records quite a lot the time. These records you don't. So they have this kind of tang of the 70s. They smell of brute. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's they have this absolute. They throw you back into the era in a way that a David Bowie record can't do because it transcends it.
Because it's around
it's so
the time.
Brilliant,
yeah.
You know, and you know it just. It just smells of Watneys and pubs you could smoke in and World of Sport and I, you know, I'm just obsessed with that era because I was very, very young in it. So I can, it seems like a very alien, foreign era, you know. You think about the early 70s now, it looks very odd compared to the time that we live in now. There's lots of things very different about it. The past is a foreign country, but it's a foreign country that I lived in and can just about remember living in. I have very kind of fractured memories of being sort of 4 or 5 years old, and that makes it just endlessly appealing to me.
Well, I've got great news for you, Alexis, because there's this thing called Brexit that you might have heard about. It's in the papers. Check it out. It's often in The Guardian, actually, and we're going to be right back there. So Power Cut Rock will be absolutely...
There is a big compilation of Power Cut Rock coming out on the day we're meant to leave the EU. Ace Records are putting out an album called When the Lights Went Out. Which is from, I think, 73 to 76, compiled with A Certain Inevitability by Bob Stanley and Pete Wiggs of St. Etienne, which is fabulous. I mean, it's such an amazing record.
Bob Stanley and Pete Wiggs and Phil King from Lush are kind of the rivals in this game, aren't they? They really are sort of, you know...
Oh, I think there's a bit of needle there, yeah.
It's a new Netflix drama coming out. Crate Diggers of Rock.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Crate Diggers and Hellraisers. I enjoyed this enormously in many, many levels, even though some of it's not objectively particularly good. What it is it's thrillingly brilliant. And being 60 tunes, it's great for just dumping on a phone and being surprised by it and listening out of order. Who would we like to force feed this record to? And you're not allowed to
all
say
your
millennials.
Own kids. All the millennials.
Would you like to have trapped them on the Fire Festival behind some kind of a barrier, made them listen?
Bring them all, and that should have been the entertainment, shouldn't it? You know,
make
bring
them listen
sleaze.
To Big Boobs Boogie.
That would have been quite fitting, actually.
You know
what?
Or I Live in Style in Maida Vale. I mean, brackets demo version, it says here. There's also a track called Lovely Lady Rock. Well, imagine if you were stuck on the Fire Festival Desert Island with nothing to do except gallons of booze, a copy of All the Young Droogs, it would have been
perfect,
the festival you were told
soundtrack.
It was going to be.
Maybe that's what that influencer was dancing around to in her house.
Big Boobs Boogie.
Hot Rod.
Spaceship Lover, that's the other one. That's a sort of B-Tech space oddity, isn't it?
Oh, bring me my TARDIS. I would like to feed this to every single singer-songwriter with an acoustic guitar and go, look, that is what pop music is. Now play that. And not on a ukulele.
Right, should we return to the present day for a bit? It's time for another track from our guests. Lucy O'Brien, what have you brought in for the listeners?
Okay, so I brought something by Skunk and Nancy, and it's the song Week. They are releasing their 25th anniversary album, so it's 25 years since their first date at the Splash Club in King's Cross. And what I love about this track is this is Skin at her most powerful. What I love about Skunk and Nancy is they're an expression of what we're brilliant at in Britain, is that kind of cross-pollination of musical styles, kind of really breaking boundaries with in terms of gender and sexuality. I was very struck when I interviewed Skin, and she said that when she started out, and she was being channeled into soul singing and an R&B because she was a black woman. And she was, well, no, you know, what inspires me is punk and rock, and my idol is Debbie Harry. And she could see her whole future mapped out for her if she sang soul and R&B, and she felt completely trapped by that. And so she deliberately went for quite hard-edged rock. And that's where she found her liberation and her power. And I think you can really hear it on this ballad.
Let's have a listen then. This is Week. This is a live thing, isn't it? This is from the new album.
Yes, so, I mean, they are a phenomenal live band and they're still touring. And you get that sense of their complete rapport with the audience.
Here we go then. This is Skunk and Nancy with Week. Finally, get your braces together, your boots on your feet, and your Walt Jabsco bus pass holder in your pocket, because two of the greats of Two Tone return this month, albeit in slightly truncated form. The Specials, now Terry Hall, Linville Golding, and Sir Horace Gentleman Panter, released their third album, if you don't count In the Studio, which Horace was on, but only for a bit. I thought Encore was a terrible title, but it leads on from Specials and more Specials, so I've now changed my mind.
Come on.
And now I understand why the cover is grey, because it's the black and white have become the same thing. Yeah. Good stuff. Also, the British incarnation of the Beat franchise, the one with Rankin Roger, return with Public Confidential. Are they any good, and how much do we owe the Rankin Rude Boy White Sox and Skinny Tie worldview in 2019? Me, I owe it 100%. Here's a couple of tracks. The Specials with Vote For Me, and the Beat featuring Rankin Roger with Who's Dat Looking?
If we vote for you, do you promise to be upright, decent, honest, to have our best interests at heart? You understand why we don't believe you. You're way too easy to see through. Not the best of places to start. There are no rocks at Rockaway Beach.
Beat and the Specials, the first and the second bands I ever saw, so it's all their fault. I'd have a proper job and a real income if it wasn't for those two. Let's talk about the Specials first. Sean, you're benched, by the way, because you wrote the biography for the Specials.
Lucy, you have to be nice about them.
Yeah, you've got to be nice. Lucy, you and I were square in the middle of this. This is absolutely our thing.
Yeah.
Were you a fan first time around of the Specials?
Yes, I was. Now, with this, before I listened to the album, I was thinking, is this going to be a bit of a nostalgia fest? But actually, as I listen to the tracks, kind of, it's a whole journey, and I think it's astonishing, actually. And it is like a completely new statement, and it's almost as if with all this politicking around Brexit, it's really concentrated their minds. They always were really strong on the lyrical side as well as the musical side. So there's certain tracks that completely stand out for me, and one of them is BLM, Linville Golding. I mean, such a powerful spoken word
track. It's basically
track,
a memoir of his whole life and how he's had to deal with racism in different forms.
Oh, devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And also, again, another spoken word piece, Ten Commandments, with this young feminist activist, Sophia Khan, kind of answer record to Prince Buster. Brilliant. I mean, this is just someone that they saw at a political rally. They thought she was a great speaker. Come in the studio. And it worked. It really works.
I think it's kind of, it sort of feels very connected to certainly the first Specials album, because you've got the, super kind of politically attuned stuff, but you've also got, you know, a cover of Black Skin Blue Eyed Boys and Blam Blam Fever and a cover of The Lunatics Have Taken Over
the Asylum. Amazing.
They've covered
that's
their
the
own, the Fun
one.
Boy 3 cover, you know, two of the Fun Boy 3 cover their own tune. So it's like, it is both amazingly fun in the way that first album, Special Album was, but also politically attuned with kind of wit and humour in a way that lots of political bands just can't do.
Yes.
And obviously Vote For Me is pretty much ghost town with a rerun, and I'm totally fine with that. Alexis, what did you think of it?
I thought it was all right. I thought it was good. I think, you know, I suppose the problem that I have with it is imagining a non-existent fourth Specials album that is the Specials altogether. I think it does sound like the Specials in place. It also takes the sort of idea of how the Specials sound forward a little bit. It's not a sort of facsimile of the first album or of more Specials sonically at all. Did I sort of think, God, I wonder what this would have been like if Jerry Dammers was involved? Yeah, I did. I mean, and that's no disrespect to the three members of the band involved, who are
and
great.
To be fair, it would have been four if poor old Brad, the most underrated drummer in history, hadn't died in 2015.
Absolutely. There's a sort of slight element of, God, what would this have been like? And I can't get away from that.
But don't we know the answer to that? What it would have been like would have been in the studio, which is a really good record, but it's a very different Specials. And the story of the Specials is they just couldn't coexist with Jerry.
No, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, if you saw the Spatial AKA Orchestra, which is sort of seemed to be what he wanted to do, I remember seeing the Reform Specials and then seeing the Spatial AKA Orchestra and then bumping into Jerry Dammers at a go at me about as Jerry Dammers is wondering, oh, you don't believe what I said. And I was like, no, I didn't say that in print. I said, I don't see where the meeting point is between what you want to do and what they want to do. And I'm not saying one's better than the other or one of you's right and one of you's wrong. It's just an immense gap. My mind boggles as to what went on at the rehearsals they actually had with them, because they did do a couple of rehearsals with Jerry Dammers when they reformed that I gather didn't go terribly well. But what the hell did it sound like?
I don't think they got that far.
Oh, really?
I don't think they got musically far. I think it was more they argued in corners and then it all went horribly wrong.
Don't you think Nikolai, is that how you pronounce his name? Nikolai Tong Larsen, he's kind of taken on that role and it's taken into a different direction. And I love what he does with the keyboards and the arranging. It's just a different feel.
It's not cosplay Specials. It's not, can we just recreate this? It is its own thing and it is moving forward.
Yes, exactly.
I particularly like the last track, We Sell Hope, which is kind of, that's sort of, you can see where the music would have branched off after more Specials, not into in the studio. It's like beautifully arranged, clever, got levels. There have been other Specials albums.
Yes.
Just not with Terry. Yeah. Is it like they're not quarter without Terry?
I think so. I think there's something about his vocal.
And he's a great lyricist as well, isn't he? I mean, his lyrics are so strong on this, particularly Life and Times, I thought.
Yeah, Life and Times of a Man Called Depression, which is him and his mental health. It's beautifully put together. For me, I thought the politics of Vote for Me are a little bit on the nose. It's like politics
that,
of
that. That interested me, actually, because I sort
schools
of thought,
where they teach you how to be stupid kind of thing.
There is an element of that about it, and I sort of thought generally about that two-tone era, in comparison to the era that we currently live in. Because people go, why isn't there a protest music now? Is Brexit, why isn't there sort of something happening like two-tone, and I think there's sort of two reasons why there isn't something happening like two-tone. One, two-tone in the history of pop music in Britain generally is a total anomaly. There was nothing like it before and there was nothing like it afterwards. There is a very small space in the aftermath of punk where you can be hugely popular and directly political, and that there's nothing else like it. It doesn't happen in the 60s, doesn't happen in the early 70s, doesn't happen later in the 80s, doesn't happen in the 90s. And two is that on-the-nose thing is just not something that pop music does anymore. If you were going to write political lyrics now, it wouldn't be Stand Down Margaret. It wouldn't be, it would have to be.
But don't you think it's there with grime and with drill? And,
to a certain
degree.
Well, yeah, they're pretty on the nose. Yeah. Yes, I suppose you're right, actually. Yes.
But also, though, it's kind of the political issue, the key political issue that that Two Tone was about, racism, we now broadly agree is a bad thing. Mm. It's no longer a thing that needs saying on Top of the Pops in the same way. It needs saying in different ways. You've got the rise of the far right, and you in The Guardian, we're always saying, where's the political music? Where's New Rock Against Racism? But when you talk about politics now in music, you do it elusively, don't you?
Yes.
It always amazed me that people think Radiohead is such an amazingly political band. You look at the lyrics, it's like, I'm being chased by a bear. Well, hang on, what is it? A Blair bear? I don't know.
What was so refreshing about listening to these albums was making it consciously political again. And I think sometimes you do need to make that conversation explicit so that people can have the discussion.
And I think now is the right time to do it. Yes. I think had you done it 3 years ago, we would all gone, this is a bit on the nose, isn't it?
Things are on the nose anyway.
It's all gone a bit.
What do we think of the beat with Ranking Roger? I enjoyed this. I thought it sounded an awful lot like the very first beat album. I just can't stop it because they know what they're good at and they put a lot of effort into recreating it. Alexis, what did you think?
Yeah, again, yes, you're right. It does sound exactly like the first beat album, doesn't it?
Which is not a bad thing.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing, although there is kind of a bit more to the beat than that, isn't there? Do you know what I mean? It's the opposite of the Specials album in that, as we said, the Specials album isn't a facsimile of of the 1979 Specials album, whereas this is a bit more consciously We Are The Beat. You know what I mean?
It's got everything there. The clicking drums, saxophones are there.
Who is in The Beat now?
It's Rankin Roger. It's Little Rankin.
I've met him. Junior Rankin.
There's also, he's not little anymore, he's quite big now. And there's also a bloke who used to be in, do you remember Beyond Records? He did all those ambient dub records in the 90s.
Right, okay.
One of those, he's like the key musical director, his name escapes me, unfortunately. And a mix of musicians, all kind of slotted into the saxo role and the Everett Morton role.
It was definitely a bit more about claiming your agency over the beat. Sound wasn't it, this record, and the Specials thing, where they clearly, we are the Specials. There's more Specials in this version of the Specials than there is in any other. I mean, it was fun, it was good.
Yeah, did you enjoy it, Lucy?
I thought it was kind of quite good, upbeat party music. It didn't move me in the way the Specials one did, but there was one track I particularly liked, and that was the father and son, where that, you know, where you've got Ranking Roger and his son kind of working together, and that really worked for me. Maybe because it felt a bit more updated and it wasn't a nostalgic version of The Beat.
Yeah, although I really enjoyed it because there hasn't been a version of this version of The Beat has not been available for such a long time. There are, of course, two franchises. There's the Dave Wakeling one in Los Angeles, which he's doing very well on the scale scene over there. It's the only example in pop, I think, of bands splitting up and going, yes, you can each keep going under one another's name. Is Two Tone slightly tarred by the fact that the fans that liked it the first time are all kind of getting a bit bored and middle-aged and Brexity now?
I think there's a whole new generation of ska fans, though, isn't there? So I think it's kind of picking up younger fans, and I think Ranking Jr. maybe represents that generation. And I think people are rediscovering it and finding new inspiration from it, definitely.
I do hope so.
I think also that if you look at things like the Specials, there is a tendency to present them as this sort of saintly kind of figures who were always on the side of righteousness, great politics. And actually, if you listen to those early Specials out, the first couple of Special albums, there's loads of things on there that we would now consider to be absolute. Their attitude to women is absolutely.
They wouldn't play live, were they, little bitch?
There's a lot of that goes on, and it's a lot of its time.
Too much, too young
is kind of wagging the finger at single mums and going, "Well, you single."
We were saying how great the 70s were. We want to go right back to the 70s. Oh no. You don't want it then, do you?
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the Special, I think that you're talking about the audience becoming Brexity and da 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 and fat and old and bored. And actually, the world the Specials inhabited was, forgive me using this phrase, not a black and white one. You know, it was a complicated, messy kind of thing that they presented. It was a complicated, messy vision. So the notion that everybody who liked it, in the same way that the notion of everybody who liked The Jam or everybody who liked The Clash or all these other bands that we hold up as these absolute paragons of virtue, with, you know, looking at the past through slightly rose-tinted glasses, they weren't.
Yeah.
They just weren't. So, you know, it doesn't really surprise me that some of their fans didn't 100% buy into the message for the next 40 years.
It's almost as if people don't listen to the lyrics and then change their lives to fit around them in politics. It's almost as if that's never, ever happened in history before.
Well, Ranking Roger's got a memoir coming out in June. I'd be really interested to read that.
I and I ranking. Okay, before we finish, I'm going to squeeze a track in. When you're in this business, you get lots of new tracks popping into your inbox every 5 minutes, and usually they're not great, but this is a huge exception. There are a bunch of teenagers from the Calder Valley between Leeds and Manchester. They're called Sid, Jake and Julia. They are of Polish and Italian extraction, so they're very non-Brexit, and they're called Working Men's Club because it's the only place they could get in to drink, and it sounds like they ought to be on the All the Young Droogs album, but as you will hear now, they sound a bit different from that. This is their debut single. It's out on 7-inch only on February the 15th. This is Working Men's Club with Bad Blood. Come to the end of the show, and that means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing as somebody snatches the traditional Bahamian sky juice out of their hands and replaces it with a plastic cheese sandwich in a polystyrene box? Lucy O'Brien, what's your closing time chatter?
We've been talking about the 1970s. I've been invited to speak at this music industry conference in Solent University at the end of March. And it's part of a big research project they're doing on the history of music in the city and culture. And it kind of ties in with Southampton at the moment is trying to rebrand itself as a city. City of culture.
Come on, Liverpool can do it, you can do it.
Yes, and they spent £30 million on an arts complex last year and they say we're going to rival Bilbao now rather than Portsmouth. Now, I grew up there in the 70s and it was such a violent, aggressive place. Their attitude towards culture was one of search and destroy. it kind of slightly tickles me that I think... Can, and this is the question really, and I sort of maybe want to throw it open if there is room in the closing chatter to ask, can you rebrand a town? Can you
introduce
or shoehorn culture into a place where there's often been a very antagonistic attitude towards culture?
Is it Craig David
culture?
From Southampton?
He is. Yes. Oh, okay. He is.
He's all over your culture.
You know, there are a few... Good South. I mean, you know, Ken Russell came from Southampton and Benny Hill came from Southampton.
There you go.
Actually. So, yes, there is some culture.
I think it can happen. I mean, obviously, Liverpool had a massive head start because we invented everything, so that's fine. We invented pop music, comedy, and football, so we're fine. But it worked for Hull as well. It does work. You know, it can be done.
You can certainly see the idea in people's mind, can't you, that more stuff happened here than you might have. You, the whole thing was sort of bound up with artists who were, you know, not necessarily thought of as being from Hull or being part of.
Yes.
Hull, whether that's Throbbing Gristle or Everything But the Girl, or you know what I mean? You thought of Hull and culture, you always just thought of Philip Larkin, and that was it.
Yes.
But of course, we're going to have our own cities of culture now because we're not in European city of culture anymore, are we? So it's going to be, you know, basically everywhere will be a city of culture before long. Alexis, what's your closing time chatter?
I interviewed a very famous pop producer a couple of weeks ago, and he got to talking about how hard it is making pop music. In 2019, in our current era, because of the limitations placed upon it by streaming services, Spotify. And the conversation haunted me to such a degree that I went home that night and at about 9:30 my wife went, what is the matter with you? You know, there's clearly something up. He basically said that because of algorithms, playlists, everything is now controlled by what streaming services want or what streaming services deem correct, from the length of a track to the length of the intro on that track to the volume that you put things at in the mix, the volume that which instrument, you know. And I found that kind of really disturbing, really scary. And he made the point, it was him that made the point about SoundCloud Rap and went, that's why that has broken through, because it didn't come through Spotify as a platform. And I started thinking about, well, there's obviously lots of instances in the past where the means by which music is disseminated has dictated, you know, how it sounds, whether that's, you know, when 78s gave way to albums, jazz changed and jazz, you know, recorded jazz became much longer and more improvisatory. And it's just bothered me ever since this guy said it. And I can't stop kind of like thinking, oh, has that been done that way? You know, he said the margins that you will never get as long as people, as long as Spotify or whatever is the main source of delivery, you will never get a Bohemian Rhapsody, you will never get a Reach Out, I'll Be There, you will never get a Psychedelic, you will never get a record coming out in pop music that makes you go, what the hell is that?
But you'll never get it in the arena of pop, which is the charts.
No.
But that's now a minority genre, isn't it?
Right.
Because you do get astonishingly weird bits of music, they just don't get into that particular chart.
Yes.
They get lauded in different ways.
Yes.
They get appear in The Guardian or Pitchfork or... Wherever.
Yeah, but I'm of an era where I want that stuff to actually be, you know, front and center. That's what makes it good. That's what Bohemian Rhapsody wouldn't be as amazing a record if it was by some obscure prog rock band that nobody knew anything about. But what's amazing about Bohemian Rhapsody is it went to number one in the actual chart.
And but can you remember anything that's been number one? I mean, you probably can actually because you cover this on a weekly basis. But who can really remember the number ones these days? They don't really matter.
What Spotify does remember is when you've listened to a track, it suggests tracks. People, and there's the New Music Friday, there's the Your Playlist, there are things that it's trying to get you to listen to as well. So if you're saying that one algorithm is selling you this song, it's going to suggest similar songs, not anything else. So it does have a big spider effect. That's what you're listening to. You're not listening to Pitchfork. I never look at the videos online and things. I will go to Spotify, sadly.
Sean, what's your closing line, Jasmine?
Well, this is good news.
Okay.
Okay. And we can make it into good news. Poetry sales are soaring. Oh, wow. Because young people are buying and consuming, as we call it now, poetry via things like Instagram and stuff like that. But it's getting out an idea that poetry is a viable thing. And also in today's quite confusing culture, it seems to be a short way of people making sense of the world. So 12 million sales last year. That is rocketing. Yes, 12 million sales of poetry books.
Don't you think there's a very young with girls. Hip-hop?
I don't know.
If you look at word.
Maybe. And you've got Kate Tempest, who's been also mixes it up and does it with music. So you've got people who just exclusively put pictures of themselves and poetry on Instagram. That gets 18-year-olds into it and younger. And I think something like that is rather wonderful, and to see where that idea of spoken word form can come at and how we are trying to make sense of the world in poetry form.
There you go, poetry. It's the new rock and roll, like comedy was years ago. We're running out of time. My closing time chatter is a very quick one. It looks like Mike Ashley's going to take over HMV. Is he going to run it like he runs Newcastle United, trying to sell 25-year-old Seahorses albums as if that's what people want at the front of the shop? Possibly not. Watch this space. That's your show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Alexis Petrudis and Lucy O'Brien for joining us.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to have you here. And they're going to stick around for the extra bit in a minute for Patreon backers, where we'll be discussing the best and worst people we've interviewed. Thanks to Sean. Thanks to producer Alex Rees. We'll see you all next time. Remember, let's just do it and be legends, man.